following interview is taking place with Jennifer Larson and Esther Waddell. Today is May 2nd, 1995, and we are at Esther's house. Esther, why don't you start with your background? Where did you come from? So on and so forth.
I was born in Newark, New Jersey. Lived and raised in West Orange, New Jersey. My mother had five children. I have four brothers. My mother was going to move to Texas, and she learned how to drive with another lady and her children, and my brothers and I, in the car, and that made about 11. So she was learning to drive a car with 11 people in the car. And she did a good job, too. And then in the middle of the winter, an eastern northern winter, she moved to Texas. I believe it was January, and I think I was about 8 or 9, maybe 10 years old. More like 9. And I remember we were going over the Smoky Mountains and everything, and we camped out on the way, and in the morning we were under a foot of snow and we could have froze to death. And my mother, I still remember seeing my mother take a dustpan and shoveling us out to get to the road to drive us down the mountain. We got to Texas, and we moved around a couple of places, and my mother got jobs, and we were basically raised in the South. And but always considered northerners, so it was rather hard that way. Where I ended up was in Coppell, Texas, which is now the Fort Worth Dallas Airport area. And in Coppell, the school was only 6-8 kids in a classroom, so it was pretty nice, and you knew everybody. There was a boys' town close by, so there was about 3/4 boys there. It was a farming community. And I moved in the middle of my senior year, in January of my senior year, which I don't recommend to anybody. And we moved, we got a letter from my grandmother, and we moved to Seattle, Washington, where I had a hard time getting back into a school because I only had a half a year to go. It was very hard for them to place me. I had to take the Washington State requirements. I had all the credits I needed, but I was underage. So it was hard finding a school to put me in. And being a Southerner now in a Northwestern state, that was very difficult. And I wasn't used to different ethnic groups and humongous schools. And I didn't dress the same. I was very out of place. But I did finish school. The thing is, by that time, we had moved to Edmonds, Washington, and I was going to a school in South Seattle. And my mother drove to work, say, an hour one way, and she'd drive us at 7 in the morning down the freeway, and I had no idea where I lived until maybe June of my senior year. And I'd be picked up at 6 o'clock at night just to go back home, and I'd sleep all the way. So that's why I never knew where I lived until summer. Never could figure out that. But I met my future husband through my mom when she had a picnic with all her co-workers. And my future husband was actually my mother's boss. And he came real late, and we barely even talked and stuff. But when he was talking about going to Alaska, he said he'd like to write me some letters. And I said, oh, yeah, sure, go ahead. And he said, would you write? And I said, oh, yeah, I sure would. Really not thinking twice about it, and by golly, he kept writing, and I just write back, nothing important and stuff, and he came down the next year in March for a friend's wedding, and invited me to the wedding, and we went to his friend's wedding, and he asked me to marry him. Well, I wasn't too sure about this, but by May, a couple of months later, by May, I got a first-class ticket in the mail, and I was soon to be on my first flight of any kind to Alaska. And he sent for me. I came first class to Kodiak, and that was April 29th, 1968. So I've been here 27 years and 3 days at this date. Right before we were married, I had no idea here in Alaska that Dick fact, it was 2 weeks before we were married, I had no idea that he had a freak accident at sea. He had gone up on a wave and there was no bottom. And he came down in a crash, and he had a wooden boat, a wooden fishing boat, about almost an 80-footer, called the Pacific Pearl. And she split all her seams. And he was just right out at Spruce Cape, and he could not make it into town. So he had to turn around and go all the way to Yuzinki and tie up to the dock, and he finally made it into town and ended up in the shipyard. He didn't make it safe, but it was really a close call, and they never really said anything. So we got married, and that's another story by itself. When I flew up here, of course, I've never been on a plane before, and I was pretty scared. I sat in first class, and I was very quiet and scared, and all the people were old Alaskans, old timers and stuff, and they were just partying up a storm. And the pilot was a friend of my husband's, and he came out and saw me and talked with me and stuff. And he said he was hand delivering me to Dick. And I thought that was kind of cute. That's the only person I got to talk to the whole flight that wasn't drunk. I came in on a Constellation, a Western Airlines plane, and that was the four engines and the three tails, three or four tails, and you don't see those anymore in operation. I wanted to be married in a church, and there wasn't very many churches in Kodiak at that time, and especially one to be available to be married in. We finally found a church that would marry us, and it was the Episcopalian Church. And I went. We were discussing with the priest about everything, and the thing that concerned me the most was all these hot dogs defrosting around the heater vents, and I didn't know what was going on. You had cases and cases. I can't imagine how many cases of hot dogs defrosting around these heater vents. And I had to ask this question, are they going to be here for my wedding? And these hot dogs were for the King Crab Festival, which I didn't know anything about. And in those days, the King Crab Festival was in early May, not in later May. But I do believe it's gone back and forth several times. It doesn't matter when it snows around here, it's going to snow either way. But they were defrosting, and they promised these hot dogs would be out of the church before I got married that evening. And I was married May 4th, and they did get them out of the church. I wanted a white dress, and I got the only white dress in Kodiak. I got, and it fit. I got the only white shoes. I wanted patent shoes, shiny shoes, but I got flat shoes, you know. I had no idea who my best man was, but it was Blake Kinnear, who owned Kinnear and Went, my husband's boss. I had a bridesmaid. I had no idea who she was. She was my husband's bookkeeper's daughter. And basically, I knew no one in town, just absolutely no one. Everybody thought I was quite very, very quiet, and I was, because I was always so scared to death. But during my wedding, I came all this way, and I'm just absolutely scared and quiet. And my husband saying his vows, I turned my head, and I noticed the priest repeating it. And he kept repeating and repeating and repeating. A third time, we were all watching my husband start to faint. He turned absolutely white, and I couldn't believe it. There he went. We were both kneeling, but he ended up on his feet, just kneeling down on his feet. And of all people, I couldn't believe he was the one who was going to faint. He also almost didn't make it through the little blood test you take right before your wedding, because he said, go first, and I thought he was being polite. No, he was just scared of the blood test. So that was really funny. I couldn't believe it. Also, before the wedding, when they asked if it was going to be a two-ring ceremony, he said, oh no, I only got her one ring. And I said, no. He means, am I giving you a ring, and are you giving me a ring? Which it was the case, definitely. But he said, no, I was only giving her one ring. So I thought that was kind of funny. But on We got married. We had no rehearsal. I was very, you know, somber looking. And we had a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful reception. And the reception was at Blake Kinnear's brand new house. He called it a opening house and a wedding party for us at the same time. And I, looking back, realized how super special that was. All the people that were there, absolutely no one I knew, except my husband, all of them were all the old timers, the people that were here from Kodiak from years ago, before the earthquake and a little after the earthquake. A lot of them were deceased, gone. A lot of wonderful memories with those people. They're all gone. And that was a pretty nice time. Our honeymoon was a little bit different than anybody can imagine. Because of the accident before we were married on the boat was in the shipyard, and there was a big shipyard out there across from the Coast Guard base. A lot of people don't remember that. We spent our whole summer pumping out our own boat twice a day so it wouldn't sink at the dock. And we couldn't get anybody to work on it because they were busy doing other things. So my husband hired on at the dock. We lost our good crew and everything, and because they have to go on with their lives. But our life was spent pumping out the boat. That was our honeymoon. Twice a day, go pump out the boat. So they finally fix it and everything. And all of a sudden, the shipyard burns down. All the paperwork, everything. All the proof of what was done, all the proof of insurance and everything, all went up in flames. So the shipyard was burnt to the ground flat. And we end up holding the bag on our boat, and it still leaked quite a bit. Dick finally fixed it and went fishing, and he was a shrimp fisherman. In those days, shrimping was year-round. Only a few boats fished shrimp. The Pacific Pearl Cannery and a couple others, and just a few boats. But then in those days, the king crab fishermen stayed in their fisheries, and the scalloper stayed in their scalloping fishery, and the halibut, and on and on. The salmon fishermen were just strictly salmon. It was a nice life, it really was. It certainly isn't that way now. Times certainly changed there. Since I never really got to know anybody for years, I went with my husband. And in those days, it was kind of taboo. I was the only female that went out on a boat, but I had nothing else to do except wait for my husband to come home. And he, at those days, he was only gone 3 days. That's the maximum you could hold shrimp on board was 3 days. And you used real ice. And then you had to have it delivered on the third day to the cannery. I remember the first Thanksgiving, he wasn't home. He disappeared at sea, and I was listening to the boat schedule, and they had a schedule twice a day, 10:30 and 3:30, for the Pacific Pearl cannery boats, and they always called all the boats on those two times. One time he never answered, and it lasted for 2 weeks. I was in the grocery store, and a lady comes up to me and says, "I hear the Coast Guard's looking for your husband, and your husband's missing at sea." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And then I got more frightened as it went on, and I called the cannery right away, and they tried to reassure me that he was fine, that he's just holed up somewhere, and he's fine, and that they've been trying to get a hold of him, and not to worry. Well, of course, that makes you worry more. But anyway, I listened. I knew I wasn't hearing him on there, and I thought I just couldn't get him. But anyway, what it was is, in the end, he was held up. He had to throw all his shrimp overboard because they rotted. And he was held up between two very tall mountains somewhere down the island. And his radio wouldn't reach out. And it was a very, very bad storm. High winds, 100-mile-an-hour winds all the time then. But he did make it home, and he lost everything he had, but he made it home safe and fine, and everything was fine after that. But we had the Pacific Pearl boat for a few years, before the fishery started changing. That's before really fish game came into the picture, and things started changing then quite a bit. When I was able to go out with him, he took me out in the summer, and he thought, oh, he didn't want me to get seasick, and usually men don't like a woman on board. But he conned the crew into, hey, look, we need an extra man on board. You either pay for another crew member, or she can go for free and help. And they kind of liked that free part, where they didn't have to lose a little bit more money out of their pockets. And I did work really hard. And I could steer the boat. I could do whatever Dick wanted me to do as far as steering the boat, and then he could work the deck. And I worked the deck and threw fish out and stuff like that. I remember when the whole crew jumped out of the... We're the only boat in those days, by the way, that had a box. Dick built a box that put all... He dumped all the shrimp in, and then you didn't step on the shrimp as much as putting it down on the deck, and you didn't squash your product. He had a real good product. But anyway, I was pulling out the scrap fish and throwing it to the birds, and the whole crew jumped out of the box once, and you're just down in there with your hands flipping this fish out, and by golly, they left me alone with a wolf eel. And then they told me what it was, you know, a brave crew that was. And they said you could put a broom handle in that thing's mouth and it would snap it in half. And it was a big one. It was a big one. So they got me out of there. They got that thing out of the shrimp net of shrimp. And I did odd things like that. I think the only time I got in a lot of trouble from the crew, and they really, really were disgruntled, was when I thought the boat was a little too dirty. And I decided, well, I am bored out of my gourd, and I'm just going to wash the walls and the cabinets and everything. I did get in a lot of trouble. I ran the water and let it go down the drain. I washed the walls. I cleaned everything. But I didn't realize we only had a 200-gallon water tank, and it was always filled up at the dock. Well, when there was no coffee water for them, and they drank coffee around the clock, I couldn't tell you how much I didn't. I never heard the end of it. It was just endless. And then they had this, they actually were so desperate, they put a little seawater and put some coffee grounds in it. It would really look gross. And it really was bad. Gosh, I've got some sea stories I could tell you about when they put pine salt on the stove instead of cooking oil and to cook pancakes. And the smell was atrocious. I could tell you about the time when they, well, maybe I better not. Well, I'll tell you anyway. Bert was always staying up at night chewing candy and stuff, and he went to the bathroom, and he in those days it was a flushing system is by taking a bucket over the side and putting it in the toilet. Our boat was the only boat that had a stateroom with the head inside. It was like a phone booth, but it was a little head. You could never get a very large person in it, but anyway, it was up by the wheelhouse, and all the other heads were outside, but this one was inside between the wheelhouse and the stateroom, and under the stateroom floors was the engine room. And then behind that was the galley. It was a really quite a comfortable boat. None of the other boats looked like that. Anyway, he went to the bathroom, used a lot of toilet paper, and he smoked heavy. So he flicked a cigarette in there. He always read a lot of paperbacks. And he went back to reading and forgot the flush. Well, all of a sudden, we're practically abandoning ship because all this smoke coming out of the head. I couldn't believe it. It just was terrible. We had our boots on ready to jump overboard. Oh, Bert forgot to flush the toilet. It was, besides stinky, it was a terrible, terrible thing. But anyway, there's a couple of times we almost had to abandon ship, but that was one of them, and thanks to Bert. But so I wasn't the only one getting in trouble every once in a while. But I was a hard crew member and a hard-working crew member, and I did my part. I even hid eggs, by the way, on Easter one time, and they all thought I was a little nuts. But I put a stocking cap on because it's cold out there in the wind, and I had rabbit ears on and stuff, and I did all kinds of funny little things like that. But they all put up with it because I wasn't costing them anything, you know. So, but anyway, Dick, in the summertime, the days are long, and Dick needed some sleep every once in a while. He could sleep standing up. He could sleep anywhere, and he still can, really. And 1 or 2 minutes of sleep is a world of difference. And his bunk was right behind the wheelhouse. And he let me steer, and I would watch the fathometer and everything, and I watched how the nets were doing. And if anything, if a pinnacle was coming up in sight, I was to wake him up. Sometimes he wouldn't even be asleep 30 seconds, and I'd have to wake him up, and which was a shame, but he knew I would do what he wanted. He knew I wasn't going to try to do anything on my own. And so he really trusted me, and he could sleep really hard for just a minute or two. And that's what I did. I did a lot of steering and on my own. I didn't sleep well in the boat. I never was comfortable about that. Anyway, he let me steer. A lot of times he would let me bring in the Pacific Pearl to the oil dock. And the oil dock would be the old Kodiak oil sails. And that's where we'd fuel up. And the ice dock was beside it. And I would bring her in there. And the ship's wheel on the top of the boat was humongous. And I would just be turning one way and turning the other to bring her in real nice to the oil dock. And I still remember seeing Peter Maya closing his eyes when I came in. I never hit a thing. I actually did a real good smooth landing several times. It was a lot of fun in those days. Then when the fisheries changed, it might have been water temperature or whatever, I don't know. The fisheries went from 12 months down to 10. Dick could see the writing on the wall way in advance, more than other people. He still does. He can see things way in the future. And you never think that's going to happen, but it tends to go hit the way he says. And the fisheries went from 12 to 10, down to 6 months, and then it just disappeared. There was no shrimp fishermen anymore. And before I got to the 6 months, he had bowed out of his boat. It was a lot of maintenance, and it was breaking down all the time. He was always working on it. And he went over to a tugboat that had just come to town. And this tugboat was going to stay. And actually, it was accidental how we got involved in that. They had, the grocery store had delivered a couple of cases of milk to our boat by accident. I don't know how they could have made a mistake from a tugboat for a fishing boat, but we were returning it to we saw the name of the boat, and we returned all this milk to the tugboat, and they really appreciated it. And he said, well, if you have any jobs on board, let me know. And eventually he did get hired on the tugboat, and it was called the Foss tug, Duncan Foss. And we ended up working on that boat for 2 years, I think, 2 or 3 years. It stayed in port, and he did a lot of rescue missions, a lot of putting out fires, and we did a lot of rescue missions with that. A lot of times that boat was never paid for a lot of the things it did, and I think a lot of people don't realize that. It got free parking, a free stall for it being the fire boat, and that's how they worked that out. And it was on contract to Sealand to bring in the Sealand ships, and that's what my husband did. He worked himself up from deckhand all the way up to his captain's papers, along with Bob Washburn, who ran the tug. In fact, Bob and Dick both got their captain's papers at the same time. Before that, you didn't even need them. It was a new era for us. We saw the old fishing fleet fading away, and it was time for us to make that change. I got to go a lot of times with Dick. It was sort of like, a lot of people just called me his shadow, basically. I got to go with him on the tug. Had I been down in the States now, I would not have been allowed on board the Foss tug. But I was so far away from the mother company that it really didn't make any difference. And I was the cook and bottle washer on that too, and Dick was on call 24 hours a day, so that's the only way I was going to see him. And got to go on a lot of missions. We had to take a doctor out one night for another sea story. We had to go out in the middle of the night and rescue somebody that was in diabetic shock, I think so, and had to take a doctor out and specifically asked for a doctor that would not get seasick. Well, I believe he wasn't liked, because he was sick before he even left the boat harbor, puking sick, and he was really, really sick. And I'm unfortunately the one that had to take care of him. And this is the doctor. This is not even getting out to the super tanker that we have to get this man off aboard. And remember, we haven't even gotten past the breakwater, and he was throwing up. It's terrible. It was just terrible. So we're supplying him towels so he could throw up in towels. And the man we were to rescue he was to get on board the tug and come back to town. And so we were bringing out just enough medicine to get him into town. Now this is a humongous super tanker we're going after. And we were going out towards Chinyak in the tug, and we ended up being in 40-foot seas. We could see the hull of the ship to the third or fourth story up. It was unreal. Of course, I never got seasick. Even that sure proved it. But actually, I got quite hungry. But I was sitting up in the wheelhouse with the captains. My husband wasn't captain at that time. He was always the mate or the engineer. Basically, I think he was the engineer, because the engineer always got the highest pay. And they had a relief skipper then, and a bald guy, Dave Edwards, a really good guy. And I loaned him my stocking hat, my knit hat, so he wouldn't be cold when he was out on the deck. And Dick, of course, was on the deck, and they were radioing back and forth. And this man on the super tanker said, I'd rather die than jump overboard. Well, personally, looking out there, I would too. And it's in the middle of the night. And they asked if there was any doctors on board that boat, and of course that ship, and of course there wasn't any. And our doctor was finally in the wheelhouse with a towel wrapped around his face, trying to talk into the mic. And they were conversing back and forth, and we ended up with, I think, one of the mates on board the super tanker getting directions from the doctor. Well, since the man wouldn't jump overboard and come onto the tug, we had to send over the medicine. And I believe we shot it with some kind of a gun and a line, and Dick had wrapped it up in a humongous plastic garbage bag to put a lot of air into it. And he was very unique in getting things done in odd situations. And it got onto the decks, and the mate had to inoculate this guy so he could be okay. And the doctor would talk him all the way through it. And the doctor asked him, what is your next port? And he's, because they only, remember, had enough medicine to go from the ship to town, which is only from Chinyak to Kodiak Harbor. And this guy's next port was San Francisco. from Kodiak, and that was unreal. The whole time we were still having a hard time keeping up with this ship, because they said they'd be still, but they were never still. They were always underway a little bit, and it was very hard for the tug to keep up. And they took the medicine, they inoculated the guy, and I'm sure he was fired after that, because you'd never go on board without medicine and stuff like that. But anyway, and then we took our puking doctor back to the dock. I think he was passed out in the captain's quarters, and I unfortunately had to clean up after him. I never felt sorry for anybody that got sick. I just had absolutely no sympathy. I was very cold-hearted about someone that would be wimpy enough to puke all over the boat. But I could go on with sea stories. I don't know if I should stick with sea stories.
Well, tell me about the housing when you first got to Kodiak.
Housing was extremely limited. Where we live here right now on Madison Street didn't exist then. This would be considered way outside of town. We lived in an apartment. First of all, that was one of the reasons I didn't come up sooner. There was no housing. There weren't the apartments. There was very little you could do, and the renters really could charge you whatever they wanted to. Anyway, it wasn't very reasonable in those days, and it was very hard, and you had to watch your P's and Q's in those days. We did get an apartment, a small apartment, and in fact, when we first married, Mr. Cessna had a lot. He was the landlord, and he had a lot of apartments in those days, and that's all his job was maintaining his own apartments. And they had a fine living, because they had they had very nice apartments too, and little houses and all kinds of units. And we had one. In fact, when we were at the shipyard during those first few months of our marriage, Stefan, we were always going to the shipyard. We spent all day at the shipyard. We found a seal on the dock, and I have a picture to show that I had a baby seal. I think she was only a couple of days old. It was just wallowing in the dirt out there, and the mother had been shot, and there was a bullet fragment in this baby. And the guy, you know, it was just left on the dock and for anybody to poke at and stuff. And I brought it home, and I put it in my bathtub. And, oh, it's just like having a baby in the house. It just, you know, it slept beside us, and it slept real well, and I cleaned it, but it really didn't eat very much. And it was very hard to feed because I didn't know how to feed it very well. They don't eat, you know, drink from a bottle or anything. But anyway, it followed me all over my kitchen, and it was really kind of cute to have. But the fishing game took it. I believe it ended up in a zoo down in Tacoma. I always want to think that. Mm. I don't know if it lived. But it definitely was going to die on the dock, you know. And so I feel like I did it good. And it was certainly cleaner when it left than when I saw it. You couldn't even hardly tell. And it was just attached to me. It would just follow me everywhere. I mean, how many people have a baby seal crawling around their apartment, you know? And then when Mrs. Cessna had her own home built, she had a very nice house across from us, and we moved into her house. And we lived there for about 6 or 7 years. It was a furnished apartment. I call it an apartment, but it was an actual house with one common furnace for about 4 houses and a washroom. It was a real nice 2-bedroom house. And the only thing is, in the wintertime, everybody would complain that there's no heat, and we'd always call her up, and we found out that there used to be a cat that goes in the furnace room, and it just turns out the little switch. And we didn't know that, or we would have gone and turned the switch back on. Well, we're always cold in the wintertime, and then they ended up building a cage around the switch because these cats would get in there and turn off the switch. When we realized that all 4 neighbors were out of heat, then we knew it was the furnace room somewhere else. But anyway, those days it was very hard to find houses. The town has changed so much. Of course, it's been over a quarter of a century. That's so much. But when I first came here, the roads were not paved. The town has certainly changed. It was just the mall area. And of course, City Market is, I can't tell you how many times bigger it is now than it was then. It was just a little bitty store. Crafts, of course, was there, and that was built after the tidal wave and things like that. But anyway, these houses did not exist then. This was the end of town. And these came way later. These came in the 70s, these houses here. And then town built out towards, going out towards Fort Abercrombie and out towards Menasha Bay. That's where all the houses started being built up, when the borough let some land loose and we could buy some land. But it took years to build out there because they didn't survey it right. They surveyed it by air and didn't allow for the contour of the land. And that really made it a pain because you had your cliffs and your drops and all kinds of things. And that really was a mistake on the borough's part, but they never did correct it. And so we bought this house, I believe, come June, probably about 21 years ago. And in those days, when this house was for sale, there was another house right downtown. It was for sale, also, and they were both the same price. And one was very old and one was brand new, and I chose the new one. But in those days, we were still in the tugs, still on call 24 hours a day, and we kind of thought, well, this would be a nice place to get away, you know, just be away from the boat, and basically that's what we bought it for. But it's a small house, but we really like it. Another question. Okay, looking back, when I came to Kodiak, looking back now, we came in on the upper road that doesn't exist anymore, where the landslide is now. That landslide only happened in the 70s. And early 70s, I don't remember exactly which year right now. And that wasn't like that. And there was an upper road, and I believe I came in on that road. And then later on, through the years, they made a real low road going between the base and town. And that was the main road. It was a really nice road. But when I came here, nothing was paved, like I said, except this upper road from the base from the airport a little bit, and then it stopped. And that was because they were redoing the whole town after the earthquake. I came, I think, a couple years after the earthquake. And my husband was here way before the earthquake. And just seems like yesterday, but I remember in town, the mall was basically very new, and Sutliff's was not as big as it was. Let's see, a lot of the stores in Shelikoff weren't there, and the old Weldon shop, the original Weldon shop was across from the Boat Harbor, and it turned into a store, and then it's back to the welding shop again under different owners. But anyway, where the public bathroom is in taxicab office, that was a wooden building was there, and it was a long wooden building with a boardwalk in the front, like a big long sidewalk, and it was the bakery that just smelled absolutely heavenly, and the bank. The bank and the bakery, and you go in one, and you'd certainly want something to eat when you went to buy. Oh, the fragrance was heavenly. The Boat Harbor, of course, was just the original Boat Harbor right down there behind that. It was not the Mirror Island or anything that exists now. City Market was very small. It was the only place to buy flowers. Dick used to buy me flowers all the time to the point where I had to say, don't buy me anymore because they would die the next day. They never would last. And I was always a frugal person. It must be my heritage. I just couldn't see something dying. I didn't want to squelch something. He was so generous, and he always bought me flowers and did things for me. But I was also so cheap that I didn't want to spend the money on something that was going to be dead the next day. I mean, here you have all these beautiful roses, and they were absolutely turned into a U-shape and aiming downward every time by the next morning. And it was kind of sad. But that flower store was in the corner of City Market, and that was such a small store. And that was when it was open on holidays, and it was still in the same place it is now. Of course, the parking lot and everything is totally different, and that's across from the police station. We never had the Dairy Queen and the McDonald's or any of that stuff. I never even thought I'd ever see the day when we would. When I came here, the Sherrier and King apartments didn't even exist. That was a field, and it had beautiful cottonwood trees there. It was just gorgeous. And above where, I think there was a hill not too far from the Orpheum, and the old school building was there, and my husband got to show me the old school building before that disappeared, and at the old school building, and it was the library too. The library downtown is new to me, and of course the fire department's really gotten bigger, and that was all volunteer in those days. Nowadays we have the sirens that go off, and that's for a tsunami, but in those days when the sirens went off, it was like volunteer fire department, and everybody raced down there to get together and get on the trucks and then go out and put out the fire. So that was what the sirens were for in those days. Mostly it was a bar town. A lot of bars were very active in those days, very sociable, and I don't recall the drug situation being any drugs in those days. It was just a lot of drinking, and I didn't drink, and my husband didn't drink, but you did go in for meals and have a beer or something, and meet somebody and have a good time, a lot of dancing and things like that. For my honeymoon, since there wasn't any place to stay, I stayed at the what they call the Westmark now, but it was called the Kodiak Inn in those days, and we always called it the KI, and I still do, and if you talk to any old timer and you call it the KI, they know exactly what you're talking about, the Kodiak Inn. I think the Kodiak Inn, once it was sold, it ended up the Sheffield and then Westmont. But to a lot of us, and I can't even consider myself an old timer, but not that I'm not aging, but I think before earthquake people and after earthquake people, the dividing line, and but the Kodiak Inn was the main spot in town for best dinners and things like that, and it certainly has expanded. But that's where my honeymoon was, and that's where I stayed. And, it was a really nice, friendly place. Pause for a second. Okay. You know, one thing I did forget is the old post office. You know, we have the new library and the new post office, but I think a lot of the old-timers remember the old post office, and that's where the, right by the ferry dock, that Canna building. Is that the name of it, the Canna building? That was the old post office, and, oh, man, that was really neat. You could get your little Yelp card if you were getting a package, and the tellers knew who you were way before you got there, and they were bringing the packages up before you even got all the way up to the line and give you your packages and stuff. It was a comfortable way of life in those days. I should say that, you know, the town has really changed a lot. In those days, we never had to lock our cars. We never had to lock our houses or anything. We never even thought about it. And Dick and I didn't have a truck. We had an El Camino, which is like a car with a truck back. And we could leave our groceries back there, our dog, whatever, our tires, anything you wanted to in this open vehicle. And you could leave it out, and you never had to worry about anybody stealing and things like that. But back to the post office, they were really a friendly group of people, and they always knew your name, you know, first name basis, and it was just a cozier town then, a real comfortable town to be in. And let's see, I remember that post office was there, and let's see, the Elks was there. And of course, they've remodeled a little bit on the outside. And Wallinger's was there. But Wallinger's wasn't two-story in those days. Wallinger's was just one story. And they added the top story, and boy, did they forget the ventilation. But because it's so hot up there. But before I came up here, I didn't even realize it. I already had a first of all, I worked in a drugstore before I came up here as I'm a journeyman druggist clerk. And I worked in a drugstore down there, and I had a job waiting for me up here, and not realizing that they had done this for me. And Mr. and Mrs. Wallinger still ran that drugstore. They still owned it, and they still ran it, but Mr. Wallinger was getting senile and stuff. But I did have a job waiting for me, and it's just that my husband didn't want his wife to work, and that's okay. I got to be with him quite a bit in those days, but I enjoyed the drugstore, and everybody, I knew everybody in there. It was just kind of cozy, and the way I got a job was through one of the salesmen on the West Coast that, sold to that store plus our store, and it was because I was buying some of the merchandise that I knew him that way. There's so many new little things now. You know, you have all your, under the Sherry and King, all those stores, and that whole building didn't even exist. What did exist, though, was the museum. It was very, it certainly wasn't as nice as it is now. The museum was a quaint little place. The yard behind it wasn't even a park in those days. It was just a bunch of old grass and not being used for anything after the earthquake. One thing I do remember is they wanted to tear that museum down. And I was a volunteer at the museum before I had children. And a lot of us got together, and we did stop it from being torn down. Urban renewal, that's what it was. Okay, urban renewal had hit Kodiak, and that's what wanted to tear the museum down to put more apartment buildings up. And everybody fought that. That building, the museum, is the oldest building on the West Coast, and we were really trying to save it. It wasn't much in those days. It was all volunteerism. Everybody, you know, worked really hard in there just to keep it going. But I couldn't see it being torn down. And so Marion Johnson is the head, and Mrs. Hatcher, and a lot of people, we all worked very hard to keep that going, and fought urban renewal and that. And then I believe the lot behind it became a park. But where the Sherry and King apartments are, they wanted the apartment buildings there, and they promised that these cottonwoods would stay up. They were, you had to see them, they were beautiful. But they said, oh yes, they'll stay up, and they cut them down anyway, and planted these puny little trees that never did live, and they never replaced them, really. But, so those apartments we all thought were very ugly, and they certainly were for those days. Then I remember one person was making this, where the Subway is, Subway sandwiches and stuff. That little mini mall-like area there. That was the biggest, deepest hole someone was constructing, and I don't know if they ran out of money or what, but it stayed the deepest hole, filling up with water every year for years. And then they made it into a fitness center underneath, and it had track and everything down there. It was quite nice. But one thing about this town is the population can't really support going concerned with the rents and expenses here. You have to have a lot more people than what we will ever have to keep anything going. But that thing is now a grocery store. But that whole thing wasn't there when I was here. None of that was. I'm just trying to reflect back. First National Bank, that wasn't there. It was a lot smaller. It was a lot smaller. The banks were even friendlier in those days. At least they were certainly more honest than they are now. You know, if you went in for a loan, you could smell like a fish, and they thought, well, fish is money, and you didn't have to get dressed up and stuff. And they would talk to you in a fair and honest manner, and if you needed a loan, they said, well, you can or can't, and you accepted it. But nowadays, you really have to fight to even get anything out of a bank. But one thing is, I've seen the, you know, one thing we didn't even talk about is I've seen the airport change. My goodness, I can't even tell you. My husband, when he came here, the airport was way across the other side of the runway, a little tiny one-room building. I can't even describe it. It's where the fish hall comes in. And that building doesn't even exist anymore. That's the original airport over there, closer to the base. And then when I came, it was just a small building on the other side where Mark Air is now. But it certainly wasn't that size. It was really small. And it was Wien Airlines, Western and Wien. And Western only came in the summer times, you know, straight in from Seattle and out. But a lot of the